Good morning and welcome to On the Margin. I'm Giovanni Russinello. It's 10:02 a.m. and you're tuned in to 89.3 WPFW-FM, your station for jazz and justice. My co-host Josephine Reed is away today, but she'll be back with us next week. And a note about that. Starting next week, we will no longer be coming to you on Monday mornings. Our new time slot will be Thursday mornings at 9 a.m., so please join us then, immediately following Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez's Democracy Now! As April winds down, we prepare to say goodbye to Jazz Appreciation Month, but not before we celebrate Duke Ellington's 115th birthday, which arrives tomorrow. Joining us by phone to help us wrestle with the life of jazz's most famous and perhaps most inscrutable composer is Terry Teachout, the author of the recently released biography, Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. Teachout is the drama critic for the Wall Street Journal. He's a critic at large at Commentary Magazine, and he's the author of a variety of books. Teachout's first stage play, Satchmo at the Waldorf, about Louis Armstrong, is currently running off-Broadway at New York's West Side Theater. He's also the author of a Armstrong biography entitled Pops, A Life of Louis Armstrong, so hopefully we can loop around there and talk a little bit about Armstrong later on, but without any further ado, let's welcome Terry Teachout and wish a happy birthday to Duke Ellington. You there with us, Terry?
Hello, I hear you loud and clear. Thank you very much.
Great, thanks for joining us. Well, we have a song playing in the background right now, and I hope you won't mind if we begin by doing a little listening. It's a song that I actually learned how to pronounce the name of, thanks to your book, so let's play this one out. It's East St. Louis, Toad Low. So, Terry Teachout, that is East St. Louis, Toad Low. Did I get that mostly right?
You sure did.
All right. So, let's begin our conversation about Duke Ellington and your new book, Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington, with a simple question. Because one might say that Duke Ellington is something like the Abraham Lincoln of jazz history. Countless books have been written on this man. The primary source materials are pretty much picked over at this point. Why did you decide to add to the heap of literature and scholarship? What was missing?
Well, to begin with, the last primary source biography of Ellington, which was actually the first one, is about 20 years old by now. And so even though the well-known source material is familiar, there's been a great deal of other material that's gotten into the mix since then. More to the point, I felt that Ellington, in his previous biographers, had either not been completely forthright about various aspects of his life or hadn't been very good about integrating his story into the larger stories of art and culture in the 20th century and the black experience as well. So it seemed to me that it really was time for a new appraisal of Ellington and the Ellington literature.
And one way that you got at that was, like you said, by sparing nothing in terms of his life, his music, the society around him. You start the book with really a witheringly sober description of Ellington. You call him sort of a hopeless egotist, someone who would never do anything he could get others to do for him. I mean, no pun desired here, but the prologue really comes out swinging. So, why is he the type of figure whose aura needed to be punctured a little bit?
Well, I didn't see it as a matter of puncturing it. I saw it as a matter of simply describing him as he really was. He was, in his lifetime, an immensely charismatic figure, and he was also a person who went to an enormous amount of trouble to control his public image. He wanted to be perceived in a certain way. And it seemed to me, not just in this book, but in the three other biographies I've written, I think that that's what biography does. It tries to show people as they are, rather than as we might wish them to be. And if Ellington was a great man and a great artist, and I think he was both, then to portray him directly and honestly is the ultimate tribute that you can pay to his genius, because that's what makes him real and not just an illusory figure, a mirage.
So let's take it all the way back. Ellington was raised in Shaw here in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
In a striving upper-middle-class black household that avoided conversations about race almost dogmatically, right?
Right.
His mother, as you mentioned, must have been mortified when she first heard her son's radio broadcast from New York City because his band was proudly performing what they called jungle music.
Oh, she must have been absolutely stunned when she heard the announcer say that on the radio.
Yeah, tell me about that. And first of all, the environment of sort of racial consciousness or lack thereof that he was brought up in, and the way that he himself had a very strong consciousness and pride that went well beyond the purview of what his mother, for instance, felt.
Well, one of the most important things that I tried to do in this book was to be more honest and more comprehending about Ellington's background. He is a member of what in his own time was known as the black bourgeoisie. His father started out as a butler, eventually started a business of his own, but he started out being in service. At that time, these were considered the very best possible jobs for a black person of the black middle class. But they also went with a certain amount of illusory role-playing. As we know, one of the people I quote in this book in trying to draw the picture of what Ellington's youth was like is Malcolm X in his autobiography, who talks about the way in which the members of the black bourgeoisie pretended to a status that the white world did not actually grant to them. Ellington was raised in a genteel environment, an environment that was, his parents were really not aware of particularly of ragtime or the developing music that came to be known as jazz. His mother liked salon music on the piano. They dressed him up so fancily that his fellow students started to refer to him as Duke. And they instilled in him, and this is the good part, the important part, the idea that he could do whatever he wanted to do out in the world. And so when Ellington finally did figure out what he wanted to do, which was to make music, he had that essential starting point for the self-confidence that really only comes from having your parents have that kind of confidence in you.
And because here we are sitting in D.C. Most of our listeners are here in D.C. getting at us via terrestrial radio, I presume. We're not that far into the future. Tell us about what the scene was like around Duke Ellington, the beautiful Howard Theater, which is now restored to what's something about like what it used to look like, was a centerpiece of the neighborhood. Tell us what was swirling around on U Street and the other places where jazz was really being born in D.C.
Well, the important part in understanding what U Street was like at and after the turn of the 20th century is that blacks of all classes, all circumstances, all economic status were jammed together. It was not a world in which the black middle class isolated itself, was able to isolate itself from the rest of what was going on for black people. So when Ellington went out and walked around the neighborhood, he could see every kind of person in every kind of circumstance. He got a good middle class education, but he thought it was just as important the education that he got in the local pool rooms. There was music of all kinds, from black sort of opera companies, black stage shows that provided chronicles of black history, to the beginnings, the rudiments of jazz. Remember that Ellington is born in 1899, and so jazz is a recognizable music, an identifiable music, is just now beginning to fan out across the United States. So he's not actually hearing a lot of jazz in Washington. The key moment for him was not in Washington, but when, as a teenager, he spent a summer in Atlantic City working for the summer, trying to raise money for himself, washing dishes, and heard for the first time a ragtime piano player, Harvey Brooks. He came back to Washington. He was inspired by that and decided to start playing on the family piano. But Ellington heard very little real jazz, what we would call real jazz, when he was living in Washington. He only heard two major jazz soloists when he was in Washington, Sidney Bechet and James P. Johnson. That was enough for him to get a sense, but he knew that he had to go elsewhere in order to pursue his dream, and the elsewhere he went was to Harlem.
And interestingly enough, the diaspora of what we now know as jazz and what back then was distinctly a New Orleans style of music, in a way, had not really fully come to fruition, like you said. Just quickly tell us, because Ellington has such a distinctive piano style, and it's so tied to the East Coast. Tell us about how those regional interactions were happening with the music.
Well, Ellington played in a style that's known as stride. That's the way that Fats Waller and James P. Johnson played. It's an outgrowth of ragtime, a more aggressive form of ragtime, more jazz-flavored, much more active left hand, but also no particular blues feeling, because pianists of Ellington's generation on the East Coast had yet to hear the great blues players from out of New Orleans. So it's a style rooted in virtuosity and the ragtime feel, but not in other aspects of the jazz style that came to become central to the music a little later on. Throughout his life, Ellington played in an increasingly simplified version of the style, just like Count Basie down in New Jersey. He started out as a stride pianist, and then he developed a more modern way of playing. And by surrounding himself, when he became a band leader, with great and authentic blues players like Tricky Sam Nanton or Johnny Hodges, he himself developed a stronger feel for that kind of playing.
So we're speaking to Terry Teachout. He is the author of Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington, which was recently released on Gotham Books, and it would be Duke Ellington's 115th birthday tomorrow, so it's a great time to be talking about the man. We're going to take another quick musical break because I want to illustrate something we're going to be talking about. Terry Teachout, stay with us. We'll be right back to talk about this tune. It is Creole Love Call.
Oh, yeah.
So that one is Creole Love Call, recorded in 1928, I believe, and it is one of Duke Ellington's earliest recordings. Terry Teachout, the story of Creole Love Call, and also another early one, Mood Indigo, those stories are a great way of getting at one side of Ellington's writing process, which was kind of an embellished borrowing process, and Those songs in particular have stories that show us the perils of such a process. Tell us what went on with Creole Love Call and how Duke put it together and how he sort of got a comeuppance.
That's right. What you heard in the opening chorus of that, and it was coming back just as we were fading out, the main theme, that gently rocking clarinet trio, Ellington didn't write that. It comes directly from a recording that had been made in 1923 by King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band. We don't know that Ellington plagiarized it. That theme was probably brought to him by somebody who was then playing clarinet in the band, Rudy Jackson. And King Oliver, when the Ellington recording came out, immediately wrote to Victor and said, I wrote that. What's going on here? But he hadn't registered it properly for copyright. And so he was never cut in on the royalties for the song, which became one of Ellington's great perennials. He played it pretty much once a night for the rest of his life because it was part of the medley of his greatest hits that he always played at dancing gigs. But what Ellington did here, and a little later in Mood Indigo, where he was using thematic material that was brought to him by a real New Orleans clarinet player, Barney Bigard, was something that he did characteristically throughout his career. Ellington is a great composer and a great original, no question about that. But he was not a great writer of tunes, any more than Beethoven or Stravinsky were great writers of tunes. His genius was in harmony and rhythm and orchestration and construction. When he was looking for tunes, he would often get them from the playing of many of the members of his band who did have a knack for the creation of melody, most prominently Johnny Hodges, his great solo alto saxophone player. He would listen to what they played on the bandstand. He might scribble it down on the cuff of his tuxedo, and the next night he might spin it into a composition. And some of the members of the band were good with this. Some were not good with it. Partly because Ellington, although if pressed, would pay you for your contribution, he tried just to pay you a flat fee of maybe $50 or $100 for all the rights to it. He did that with one of his most famous and successful ballads, Sophisticated Lady, whose melody is actually taken directly from a pair of warm-up figures that were played by Lawrence Brown, the trombonist, and Otto Hardwick, the alto saxophone player. I think he paid them, I can't remember if it was $25 or $50 a piece for all the rights in that song. But when I say all the rights, I mean all the rights. They never shared in the royalty after that. Brown never forgave him for that. He used to say that Ellington wasn't a composer, he was a compiler. Of course, Ellington was a composer, but he was a composer who took what he heard and made the best and most imaginative possible use of it.
And you think of him almost like, to me, almost like a novelist who has the license to take nonfiction or fiction and spin it into a novel as she pleases, right? Like,
you know, that's a really good comparison, and I have to admit, it didn't occur to me when I was writing the book, or I would have stolen it from you. But novelists absolutely take people that they have known in real life, in their own lives, and they fictionalize them. And that's actually quite a good metaphor for what Ellington did.
Mm.
It doesn't mean that he is, in the normal sense of the word, a plagiarist. He almost always knowingly got permission to use this material. He usually paid for it. And after some of the members of the band caught on to what he was up to and how valuable the copyrights were, they insisted that they be cut in.
Right.
Song royalties. And as Billy Strayhorn, his greatest collaborator, said, remember that none of these members of the band ever wrote hit songs on their own. And that's absolutely true.
Yes.
It took Ellington to hear the potential in the melodies and melodic fragments that they improvised and transform them into real full-scale compositions. That's another important part of his genius.
Exactly. A synthesizer, right?
Yes.
We're talking to Terry Teachout. It's Monday, 10:22 a.m. on April 28th. I'm glad you're tuned in to WPFW here, 89.3 FM in the nation's capital. The subject that we're talking about is Duke Ellington, his life, his legacy, and the recently released biography by Teachout, which is called Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. Your prologue, Terry Teachout, pivots around black, brown, and beige. which is Ellington's first real long-form symphonic work of its stature. And he began touting this work in 1930, even though he'd hardly written a lick of it, and it would be 13 years before he performed it. Why is it that almost immediately, and this is not just about his artistic process, but also about his consciousness and the role that he saw himself playing in America, why is it that almost immediately upon stepping under the national spotlight, he's declaring that he is going to make a tone parallel, in his words, to the history of the Negro in America? Why is this something he knows almost from the outset that he wants to do?
Because Ellington was seen as, and wanted himself to be seen as, a spokesman for racial pride in America, for the pride of the black community. He was fascinated by black history. It was something that he actually read about quite extensively, had a very large collection of books about it. And he was publicized from the outset of his professional career when he began to work with the white manager Irving Mills. Mills presented him not just as another band leader, but as a composer, a distinctive and original composer, comparable in quality to classical composers. This was a publicity gambit, but it was also the truth. It had the advantage of being true. And Ellington, being a member of the black middle class, was uncomfortable even with the word jazz, which is deeply rooted in New Orleans and in its bordellos. The word jazz is itself widely thought to have been at some point a synonym for sexual intercourse. Ellington thought that the music he played deserved much more respect than that, just as he thought that the blacks as a group deserved more respect than that. And so he got the idea very early on, at the beginning of the 30s, when he began thinking about the possibility of writing large-scale pieces. He got the idea that he wanted to write one that was, to use the phrase he coined, a tone parallel to the history of the American Negro. Now, he had already been up to that kind of thing. Look at the titles of his compositions, pieces like Black Beauty, Echoes of the Jungle, Creole Love Call. Over and over again, his pieces evoke specific aspects of and images from black history. And so it stood perfectly to reason that when he decided to go for the big score and write a large-scale piece of music, a real large-scale piece of music, Black, Brown, and Beige is 45 minutes long, and he wrote it for his Carnegie Hall debut, that this would be his chosen subject matter, because it was something that was just almost written into his musical DNA.
And being at Carnegie Hall for him was a grail in and of itself, right?
Absolutely. He was not the first jazz musician to perform there. The first jazz band leader to give a full evening concert there was Benny Goodman. Ellington wanted it to have been him, and some of his musicians, in fact, played at Goodman's concert in 1938. But when he finally got there at the beginning of 1943, he knew that this was a great occasion, not just for him, but for blacks in America generally. And he knew that he needed to make a splash. He couldn't just come in there and play the same kind of program that he played, you know, at a dance in Poughkeepsie. He had to shoot for the very highest target, the high C, hence Black, Brown, and Beige.
Right. And that's interesting that you mention his audience and the racial composition therein, because right around this time, the 1930s really, there starts to be a trend toward more white audiences at his shows, although maybe you could say it's always been that way. He started out at the Cotton Club, which was a segregated club in Harlem. That was where he got his really big start in New York City. What was it in the fact that his audiences tended to be more white than black? How did he feel about that?
Well, he was always playing for black audiences at one time or another. You know, Ellington, for example, toured the Deep South and played both for segregated audiences and occasionally for all black audiences. He played both in black and white movie theaters when he did tours of theaters, which used to be a very important thing. But increasingly, he was playing for more and more white audiences because that was where the money was. And even though he was esteemed immensely by his own people. There's a wonderful chapter from a book by Ralph Ellison in which he talks about the experience when he, Ellington, was a teenager of hearing the Ellington Band in Oklahoma City in the 30s. Even so, the Ellington Band was acquiring a substantial white audience, and eventually, and by the end of his life in the 70s, most of the people who went to hear him, and pretty much every other jazz musician, were white rather than black. Carnegie Hall was important to him as a symbol because of what it was. It was Carnegie Hall, America's great temple of classical music. And Ellington believed that the music he made, which he liked to call Negro folk music, he never used the word jazz to describe his own music, but he felt that it was a completely independent but equally serious form of musical expression comparable to classical music. And so the idea of going to Carnegie Hall to play a large-scale piece of music that he wrote, it is a great, not just a gesture on behalf of blacks, but something that goes right to the center of his own ego, his own psyche. The idea that he is good enough to write a piece like this and play it at Carnegie Hall.
We are speaking once again to remind everyone, we're speaking to Terry Teachout, who's the author of the recently released Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. We're going to take a quick break for PSA, station identification, and to listen to one more piece by Duke Ellington. Don't go anywhere, we will be right back in a few minutes with more of this conversation.
There are many ways to support WPFW. One easy way is by volunteering. To find out how you can help with our spring membership drive beginning May 4th, you can call us at 202-588-0999, extension 360, or email us at volunteers@wpfw.org. That's 202-588-0999, extension 360. Support the station and the programming you love by becoming a volunteer today. Thank you.
You're listening to WPFW FM 89.3, DC's station for jazz and justice, coming to you at a full 50,000 watts thanks to our newly restored transmitter. I'm Giovanni Russinello, and you're listening to On the Margin. Please don't tune in expecting us next week at the same time. Tune in anyway, but we will be hopped over to a new time slot, Thursdays at 9 a.m., just after Democracy Now!, so find us there from then on. That's Thursdays starting next week. I'm talking today with Terry Teachout, who's the author of Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington, and the tune that we just heard was called, well, it's the first part of Reminiscing in Tempo. Terry Teachout, it's based on sort of Duke Ellington's wistful feelings and looking back after the death of his mother, which is a huge moment in his life. It's maybe his first experience with really deep agony. It's the loss of the woman who had babied him and believed in him through his whole life, and it's the impetus for what you argue is really his first successful long-form work.
Yes. Ellington, although it was important to him psychically to write large-scale compositions, he didn't do it all that many times. He sort of had a trial run in 1930, with Creole Rhapsody, which takes up both sides of a 78. And then in 1936, he writes Reminiscing in Tempo, which is a four-sided composition. It runs for about 12 minutes. There had been attempts by jazz composers to write on this scale, but very few of them at that time. And this was the only one that received any kind of commercial recording at the time. So it was much discussed. It was quite controversial. People came down on both sides of whether or not it worked as a composition. And it works and it doesn't work, in my opinion. It has extraordinarily beautiful things. Its ambitions are to a great extent fulfilled, but it's a bit harmonically static. And to me, the reason for this is because Ellington deliberately did not familiarize himself with any kind of classical music, which would have provided him with the architectural models for large-scale composition that he just couldn't find in the world of jazz. He not until really toward the end of his life did he do any systematic listening to classical music at all.
And you say, as a result, it's, quote, something in between true large-scale development and Ellington's now familiar mosaic method of composition.
Yeah, Ellington liked to write pieces of music by putting together fragments. He'd write, 10 bars here and 24 bars there. He'd try them out on the bandstand or in the recording studio, and then he'd get into the studio, and he'd tell the musicians what to do. He'd say, okay, we're going to start at letter B, and then you're going to jump to page 6, do this and do that. And he had an extraordinary knack for being able to pull together these fragments. But that kind of mosaic method really only works well on a small scale. And bear in mind that virtually all of what the music that Ellington wrote during the major phase of his career was written so that it would fit onto a 10-inch 78, which plays for about 3 minutes. When Ellington starts to get above about, the 6 or 7 minute mark, you start to see the difficulties with the mosaic method, that he really can't maintain musical direction over a larger span within the limitations of time that were determined by the 78 record. He was just about perfect. He was, I think the phrase I use for him at the end of the book is a disciplined lyric miniaturist. And I compare him to Chopin, to Hugo Wolf, or to people outside music like Paul Klee, who made very small paintings, or Flannery O'Connor, who was really only effective writing short stories. Just because you're working on a small scale doesn't mean you're not a great artist.
And we will get to sort of the figure who bridges him to another place, which is Billy Strayhorn, who has, as you argue, a much more coherent sense of a full narrative structure to long-form pieces and even to short-form pieces. But for a second, let's stay on Reminiscing in Tempo. He wrote it on the train. Ellington's relationship with the train is legendary.
Yes.
It was a refuge from racism in a way, and his own car was a refuge from the rest of his band. Tell us about the train and Ellington's life and music.
Well, to begin with, when Ellington started performing in the Deep South, there weren't any hotels for blacks. The band would have to be put up in in boarding houses on a catch-by-catch-can basis if you were taking a bus. Very often you ended up sleeping on the bus if you were a black musician. So the way that Ellington, who was a man of tremendous dignity and insisted that he be treated with the dignity he deserved, the way for him to avoid this kind of treatment was to charter private Pullman cars that would be attached to trains. The band could sleep on them. They would have Pullman berths. He would have a stateroom. And this way, they simply didn't have to be exposed to the indignities of life for blacks in the Deep South. Beyond that, Ellington, remember, he's on the road maybe 300 nights a year, maybe more, but he's constantly composing. And composition is generally not something that you do in a crowded room. He had defined places where he could work, and on a Pullman car, he had his own stateroom. He could simply close the door. And he found great inspiration in the passing scene that he saw from outside his window. He was fascinated by the sound of train whistles, which he often incorporates into his music. Just the sound of the train wheels themselves, clickety-clacking on the tracks. There's a wonderful piece he wrote called Daybreak Express, which is it's a tone portrait of a train pulling out of the station, a high-speed train.
Yeah.
At the end of the record, you know, it slows down and stops. And, you know, Ellington, he was one of these rare birds who was inspired not just by purely musical stimuli, but by everything that he saw and heard. He was a synesthete, a person who when he heard tones, he saw colors. And that's something that gets into his pieces. Often his pieces depict states of mind or states of emotion. They're not just purely musical.
And like Mood Indigo, they often refer to colors, right?
That's right.
So the time when he was really going around America on the train almost nonstop was the mid-30s.
Yeah.
And it's the beginning of the swing era. And as you say, Duke Ellington's story, like everybody's story, is embedded in the politics of the age. His music really helped plant the seeds of the swing era, but he suffered when it arrived.
That's
because
right.
White bands became favored in the press and by venue owners.
Yeah, really for two reasons. One was he was black. And when white band leaders started to get good at making big band jazz, starting with Benny Goodman, who was the first really successful white band leader of that period, white bookers, white dance halls, places like that, they would, when possible, book the white band. Beyond that, what we call swing, the music of Goodman and his contemporaries, and also of certain black band leaders as well, like Count Basie, represents a streamlining and simplification of the complex music that Ellington had been writing from the late 20s through the mid-30s. So Ellington's music, although it's obviously jazz and it does swing, presents greater challenges than the simpler dance-driven music that bands like Goodman, band leaders like Goodman and Basie specialized in. So it started to get a little bit difficult for him at that point.
And there was a lull and, of course, a big surging back soon after that. So let's take a break with a little bit more music featuring the great bass player Jimmy Blanton, and then we'll come back and talk about his band in the early 40s.
Thank you.
That is Pitter Panther Patter, which is from the few but mighty recordings that Duke Ellington made just in duet with his bassist Jimmy Blanton, who joined the band right at the beginning of the 1940s. Tell us about the effect of an amazingly huge bass sound like Jimmy Blanton's on Ellington and on jazz, and also tell us about that band, the Blanton Webster Band of 1940 to 42.
Well, let's put it in perspective. Remember, Ellington is a musician who draws inspiration from the people in the band. And every time he brings somebody new into the band, it's like a creative jolt for him. So he's been tinkering with the personnel of this great band that he's had over the preceding decade. And he's never had a virtuoso bass player, because there weren't any. And he's never had a great tenor saxophone soloist. So toward the end of 1939, he pulls into St. Louis on tour, on the Endless Tour. There are different versions of how it happened, but the one I think is most likely is that Johnny Hodges went down to a nightclub in St. Louis, and he heard this boy, 20, 21 years old, who was playing the kind of bass that you heard just now at a club. And he went back and told Ellington, "You got to come and hear this guy." And
he roused him out of bed, right?
Yeah, according to one story, Ellington actually went there in his pajamas and a raincoat, and he heard Jimmy Blanton, and he hired him, got him onto the band. I think he's first known to have, people first started writing about him within a couple of weeks after he began touring with the band, and very shortly after that, Ben Webster, a great tenor sax player who had always wanted to play in the Ellington band and had actually subbed a couple of times and made a couple of records with him, finally got loose, and Ellington hired him, brought him in at the beginning of 1940. So the great tinkerer, the great seeker after inspiration, finally gets the perfect instrumental lineup for his band.
And it
was just like somebody had plugged him into the wall of creativity. Suddenly he lights up and begins just spurting forth masterpieces, one great record after another, recorded between 1940 and 1942. And that group, obviously because these two people had joined it, has come to be known as the Blanton Webster Band.
And it's a fascinating time, which I just want to take a little diversion here. It's a fascinating time because it's the time of the Musicians Union strike and the recording ban.
Well, that was what dropped the curtain on the band as far as making records went, because in 1942, the American Federation of Musicians, for complicated reasons not worth going into on this broadcast, decided to instruct its members not to make records. And as a result of that, suddenly the band has to stop recording right when it's at the absolute peak of perfection. It continued to perform at an extraordinarily high level for several years after that. But we no longer, from that point on, have any documents until 1944, the way it sounded. But fortunately, Ellington had just switched labels in 1940. He was recording for Victor. They were really good at capturing the sound of the band with great clarity on those old 78s. And from this period, you have something like three dozen recorded masterpieces of the very highest level of quality. And we were talking a moment ago about how Ellington was a bit in the doldrums, you know, because of the coming of the swing era. Well, what pulled him out of it really was just the fantastic quality of this band. People heard it and they said, "Well, this is different. This is even better than the Ellington we used to know." And suddenly, this arc of creativity climaxes with the Carnegie Hall concert. Yeah, which is by the Blanton Webster Band. By that time, Blanton was dead of tuberculosis, but the rest of the band was still intact. And the whole world knew.
And there's a secret ingredient to this band, and we really do mean sort of secret.
Yeah.
We've hardly even uttered the name ourselves this hour, and that's partially my fault, but I've been waiting in the shadows here to talk about Billy Strayhorn. Again, I just want to take this time a very quick pause for a theme that everyone will recognize, written by Strayhorn, and then we can come back and talk about it.
Yeah.
So that one, of course, is Take the A-Train. Terry Teachout, the author of the recently released Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. Who was Billy Strayhorn, and why does the average jazz fan know so little about him?
Strayhorn was Duke Ellington's closest musical associate from the time he joined the band around 1939 to his death in the mid-60s. He was Ellington's assistant composer. He was his collaborator. He arranged many of the tunes not by Ellington that the band played. And he wrote the band's theme song, Take the A-Train, which we just heard. That itself is a tribute to Strayhorn's genius, that a great composer like Ellington should have chosen to have Strayhorn's tune become the theme song of his band. He was a child prodigy from Pennsylvania. He was, unlike Ellington, classically trained and initially thought that he would be a classical pianist, a concert pianist. But, of course, that course was not open to blacks in the 30s. So he started to play jazz. He began to see himself, I think, as a kind of a Gershwin-like figure. Then he heard the Ellington Band, first in a film and then on stage, and he realized that they were playing a kind of music that was compatible with his own interests. So he managed to wangle a backstage invitation to meet Ellington. He sits down and he plays for him. And Ellington is staggered at the young man's gifts and says, I want you to go with the band. I want you to become part of my organization. Come to my place in New York. And here's how you get there. You get to New York and you take the A train up to Harlem. That was actually how that song got its name. So Strayhorn starts arranging for the band, then writing original compositions. Ellington, of course, instantly realizes that he's got somebody who can figure out his own musical secrets, crack the Ellington code, so to speak. And their musical relationship becomes extraordinarily close. It was a kind of a father-son relationship. But like all father-son relationships between two very creative people, it was inordinately complicated because Ellington was a credit hog. And while he sometimes gave Strayhorn full recognition for what he did, sometimes he didn't, and sometimes he cut himself in on the royalties. Further complicating the situation was the fact that Strayhorn did not appear in public with the band. The reason why he did not do so is because he was gay. It was no easy thing for a person to be openly gay, as Strayhorn was in the 30s. Strayhorn had the talent to have led a band on his own. But if he'd done that, he couldn't have lived the life he wanted to lead, a life of comparatively open homosexuality with a long-term partner. And so he made another choice, which was to remain in the shadows, to have Ellington play his music but not be a part of the band performing in public. And that became an increasingly difficult bargain for him.
One of the most heartbreaking scenes in the book is the point where his seams come apart just ever so much, and he breaks down when his friend confronts him about Duke Ellington's lack of giving credit, really.
Right. Duke had just been written up, I think it was in Look magazine. There was a big piece about him, and Strayhorn is completely, no mention of him at all. And the friend confronts Strayhorn and says, why do you put up with this? And he says, oh, you know, let Edward have his publicity. And then suddenly he bursts into tears because he realizes, maybe just at that moment, who knows, but he realizes just how much of a price he's paid for living the life that he wanted to lead. But he made his decisions when he was a very young man in his 20s.
So let's talk about musically, because I have to emphasize one of the things that this exhaustive, really enthralling biography does is it takes us deep inside the music. All the way along, we really get a feel for what Duke Ellington's innovations were, how he progressed, and also, in your expert hearing, what the shortcomings were. What do you think Strayhorn, more than anything else, what did he add to the Ellington repertoire and to the Ellington songbook?
Well, for one thing, Strayhorn, unlike Ellington, was a great melodist, a great composer of tunes. Also, as a result of his classical training and his knowledge of the classical repertory, Strayhorn was especially interested in the music of the French Impressionists, Debussy and Ravel. Ellington scored for the band and for the specific musicians in it. And so their music, although very different, the two composers complement each other very, very well. And this becomes more apparent to us in the 50s after they finally work out a deal where they're both jointly credited for the suites on which they both work. They're all credited to Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn. And so we really get a chance on albums like Such Sweet Thunder to hear their two styles juxtaposed directly, one next to the other. And you realize that whereas what people always said about Ellington and Strayhorn was that you couldn't tell them apart, the fact is that anybody who listens attentively can immediately tell their styles apart. And they blend together into this great style that is that of the Ellington band, but they were very distinctive, creative voices, each to his own.
So, Terry Teachout, the author of Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington, we are wrapping up here. It's 5 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to 89.3 FM, DC Station for Jazz and Justice. It's WPFW. I'm Giovanni Russinello, and you've been listening to On the Margin. What is the final verdict on Duke Ellington after years of research? What should we take away on this, the eve of his 115th birthday?
One of the great composers in any genre of the 20th century, one of the most fascinating and complex personalities, not necessarily a person whom you would trust with your life or your wife. We haven't even talked about that side of his interest. But one of those figures without whom music in America would never have been the same. And as he meant to be, a great symbol of and spokesman for black pride.
There you have it. We'll have to leave it at that. Terry Teachout, thank you so much for being with us on the Margin here this morning. It's been great to talk.
My pleasure entirely. Thanks for having me.
I want to thank our man at the boards, Mike Nasella, and want to remind everyone that we have some great programming coming up in the next couple hours. At the top of the hour at 11 a.m., you'll be hearing To Heal DC with Jody Eisenberg and Chuck Hicks. And at noon, this Monday's edition of Don't Forget the Blues comes to you thanks to Elliot Gross. So don't go anywhere, but do make sure that if you're trying to catch On the Margin next week or any week thereafter, you don't tune in now expecting to hear us. Tune in on Thursday morning at 9 a.m. We will be following Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, and my co-host Josephine Reed will be back with us starting next week. So hope to catch you then. Thanks again for listening. I'm Giovanni Russinello signing off. Thank you.